It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up later, we'll hear about an effort in Milwaukee to find photos and share stories of some of the state's Vietnam veterans. First, we're talking about an issue that's being debated in Wisconsin right now, restrictions on public assistance. In his budget proposal, Governor Scott Walker included a provision to drug test people who use food stamps and unemployment benefits in Wisconsin. That measure was just approved by the Joint Finance Committee last week. Republican state representatives have also introduced legislation that would ban certain kinds of groceries someone can buy with food share, including cookies, chips, energy drinks, soft drinks, seafood, or steak. Congresswoman Gwen Moore says putting restrictions like these on people who need public assistance is, to her, political paternalism. She makes her case and critiques similar legislation in other states in a piece for The Guardian that you can find on the Central Time Facebook page. Gwen Moore joins us now. She represents Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District, which includes Milwaukee. Congresswoman Moore, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Veronica.
Well, you call these kinds of restrictions on public benefits forced political paternalism. What do you mean by that?
Well, Veronica, what I have to say is this is very reminiscent of the old Ronald Reagan welfare queen mythology, the demonization of the poor for the purpose of reducing the budget and being able to justify it. And it's reminiscent of those kinds of myths, and it's shameful because food stamps in particular have kept literally millions of people out of abject poverty.
Now, there's a line from your piece in The Guardian that I want to quote. It says, "The implication that those battling poverty are more susceptible to substance abuse is as absurd as it is offensive." Is that the subtext that you see?
Oh, absolutely. And not only is it absurd, just on the face of it, because it's been demonstrated time and again that there's no evidence, no scientific evidence at all, that people who are poor use drugs more than anyone else, and perhaps some have shown that they use drugs even less. So it's a waste of money. It's a waste of taxpayer money and time. But more importantly, it's just unconstitutional. And it really violates people's basic protections against warrantless searches without any probable cause. And to demonize people who are poor. Here in Wisconsin, for example, there's a legislative proposal that's just passed one of the chambers of the state legislature that would provide for drug testing of folk who receive food stamps, SNAP, Medicaid, and unemployment insurance, for example. And, so in the case of food stamps, for example, the whole purpose would be to cut SNAP benefits by $71 million a year. So if it's your purpose to just cut the benefits, be transparent about that and not build this straw man that somehow welfare recipients, two-thirds of the food stamp recipients, two-thirds of whom are children, elderly, or the disabled, are drug addicts.
Now, advocates of this kind of public benefit legislation to maybe drug test or limit foods bought say they're trying to save money, that this amounts to fiscal responsibility, a way to make sure the tax dollars go where they're supposed to go. What do you say to that?
It's a way to unconstitutionally and against the Department of Agriculture policy for food stamps to create barriers that will clearly prevent some eligible people from getting food stamps. I want to reiterate that, about 40% of the people who receive food stamps are children, people who don't use drugs, who don't work, can't work. And they're in households, 80% of the households have someone there who is already working. The whole point of this program is to not really help people. It is really to demonize the poor so that there can be a cause célèbre for trying to really diminish the benefits of a program that works very well. We tried this last Congress. On the federal level, and it didn't pass, even with a very conservative Congress. And so in places like Wisconsin, Governor Walker knows full well that there will be legal challenges to this that could in fact prevail. But in the meantime, it just sort of stirs up, you know, some of the dog whistle and some of the sort of demonization of the poor that really could propel him his signature politically. And it's a shame because food stamps work so well, Veronica. They work in tangent with the counter-cyclical nature of our economy. When times are good, food stamps usage drops. When times are bad, it's the only thing people have to hold on to. And when I look at my constituents here in the Milwaukee area and have the largest concentration of African Americans, have a huge concentration of Hispanics, you know, cutting time-limiting food stamps, creating that barrier, drug testing folk, these are measures that will cut, again, $71 million out of the food stamp program at a time when we have the second highest unemployment among African Americans in the country, at a time when being a black child is worse in Milwaukee, Wisconsin than anywhere in the nation. Here is a time that we're going to have a public policy that diminishes public support even more, and that is frightening, Veronica.
We're talking right now with Congresswoman Gwen Moore, representing Wisconsin's 4th District, about her recent opinion piece in The Guardian on public assistance restrictions. And at the core of some of these laws is the idea that fraud is being prevented. How significant a problem is fraud in these programs, you know?
Oh, Veronica, give me a break. The SNAP program, formerly known as food stamps, is one of the best administered programs in the federal government. There's very little fraud and abuse, and to the extent, there's nothing like in some of the other important programs like Medicare. But it's such a small number in comparison to the numbers of millions of people that literally are lifted out of abject poverty. It's very well run. And what people are talking about when they talk about restrictions, no seafood, no lobster, no crab, there are patterns of food stamp usage that these proponents of these measures try to rally the rage against them, and it's totally unjustified. There have been food stamp recipients who have swapped cash out with other people so that they can buy deodorant and sanitary napkins and diapers. We have known of instances where people have, you know, for single people, people who have no children, maybe an elderly person, might get a benefit of $20 a month. There have been seniors who literally saved a 3-month allocation of food stamps so that they can have a nice Thanksgiving dinner, or that they could buy their kid a birthday cake. I have personally been in line when people have sneered at a cart where someone went out and bought their little 7-year-old kid a birthday cake. Ridiculous social engineering, humiliating people because of their poverty. When you look at the unemployment numbers, especially in my district, in my community that I represent, it is totally not totally the responsibility of individuals that jobs are lacking, that they have not recovered from the recession, and these measures are designed to humiliate them as poor people for political purposes.
And as we wrap up, I want to ask you, in your recent piece in The Guardian, you write that you grew up in a low-income household in Wisconsin. What do you want people to know about low-income people, maybe people who use these benefits that they may not know?
Well, you know, what I can say is that, we live in a democracy, and this is a very precious notion to me. And in a democracy, everybody has basic opportunities. Many of my Republican colleagues were talking about life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness in terms of a very narrow abortion debate. But I said, what about just basic feeding each other, breaking bread, and making sure that people have at least the minimum standard of food? I benefited from that. You know, I was nobody. I was not a congresswoman. I was one of nine children, poor, on welfare, government cheese, government subsidies, peanut butter, public education. But because of a community that thought I was worth it to give me a sandwich and a glass of milk and an education, I am now representing, you know, over 700,000 people, and I want to protect them from the ignorance and homophobia and classism that these kinds of policies really promote.
Representative Moore, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Congresswoman Gwen Moore representing Wisconsin's 4th District, which includes Milwaukee. She joined us to talk about her recent opinion piece for The Guardian on restrictions for public assistance. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, summer has officially started. We have film critic David Edelstein with us for a preview of what's coming out for summer movie season. First, it's Memorial Day, where we pause to remember the men and women who died while serving in the country's armed forces. While the casualties of war can sometimes feel impersonal or distant, an ongoing project is looking to change that. The Face for Every Name Project is a national effort to match every name on the Vietnam Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. to a corresponding photo. Residents of each state are working hard to find pictures for all their state's service members. Only a few states have found them all. Our next guest is making a push to add Wisconsin to that list. Jessica McBride is with us now. She's a senior lecturer of journalism at UW-Milwaukee. Along with her students, she's been working to find the remaining photos as well as the stories of some of the men who served. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, Jessica, give us a little bit of an update. How is the project going right now?
Well, as of about a week ago, we were down to three final names. When the students got involved in this project in February, there were 64 Wisconsin service members who died in Vietnam for whom they were missing photos for the national project. So I told my students, you know, these are supposedly the unfindable 64, but I'm of the personal belief that everybody is findable, and obviously all of these young men deserve to be remembered, deserve to be humanized, so we set out to find their photos and in some cases their stories as well. So again, we were down to three about a week ago, and then we were down to one. And as we stand here today, officially, the final name that we are seeking a photo for is a man from Milwaukee by the name of Willie Bedford.
So from 64 that were deemed unfindable down to one, how do you feel about that progress?
I feel really proud of the students and also the other volunteers who contributed, you know, to this project over really what's been a couple of years. I mean, I did want to underscore that point. There have been so many people from all walks of life and all generations all over the state of Wisconsin who have found photos for this project. There was a Medford teacher who found 600 of the pictures with his K-12 students several years ago when this started. And there's also a local Vietnam-era veteran from Baraboo who drives down to the Milwaukee Public Library several times a week in some cases, and he sits there poring through obituaries, old newspaper articles, and he's found a very large number of photos also. His name is Terry Kramer. And then there's my team of journalism students from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I felt they really poured their heart into these projects. You can find their stories on our student news site. It's called Media Milwaukee, www.mediamilwaukee.com. The stories are rich, they're human, they're very interesting. They found a lot of photos, but they also tried to do what really the media didn't do back in the late 1960s and early 1970s, which was properly humanize these men and tell us, you know, who they were as human beings. I was sort of surprised by that as a journalist myself and a journalism instructor to see how little was written about these men in most cases when they died. The media at that time would tend to write news briefs, and they would just say so-and-so died in Vietnam, and he's the next of kin of so-and-so. There was very little done to actually tell, you know, the community who these men really were. So the students tried to write really that rough draft of history that wasn't done at the time.
Why do you think that was the case, that there were just these briefs and that now you're going back and getting the chance to deepen it, but why wasn't there more there initially?
You know, I talked to my father about that. He's a reporter, and it was interesting, but he turned up in a class photo with one of the men I was seeking the photo of. And I looked at the class photo, and my father was in the same class at Marquette University High School, so I asked him that question. And he said, well, at times there would be 500 people across the country dying a day. He said that I couldn't really perhaps appreciate the number of casualties that were happening, so I think perhaps that was part of it, just that there were so many. And I also believe it may have been the unpopularity of the war at the time. It was certainly a different media also. You know, it was limited largely to the paper trail of newspapers. I guess those are my theories, but I find it very disappointing. At the same time, if the newspapers hadn't taken the trouble to document the names of these men, at least, and their next of kin, it would have been a lot harder to track down those family members today and to get these photos.
We're talking about the Face for Every Name project with UW-Milwaukee's Jessica McBride. And Jessica, tell me a little bit about how many Wisconsinites served in Vietnam. You got involved when you were down to 64, but how big was this effort initially?
It's a pretty long list. There's 1,161 Wisconsin service members who are on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. There are some veterans organizations that believe that's an undercount, and there's a movement also by Wisconsin Public Radio to document Wisconsin service members who died in Vietnam but who enlisted from in other states, so they're not in the official Wisconsin count. But the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund, which runs the wall in D.C. and which is doing the FACES project, they use the official Department of Defense count, so we have 1,161. And again, Willie Bedford, the final name on that list. So it's very unusual for a state to have found all of its photos. There are only a few states that have: North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, New Mexico, and Iowa. I believe Minnesota has four left to find, so we would be, you know, on a very small list. And we had far more service members who died in Vietnam than those other states also. So it's been a monumental effort by people all over the state from all walks of life and all different forms of media also. Various reporters all over the state have found photos. I found seven myself for the Waukesha Freeman newspaper of young men who were from Waukesha County. The father of one of them, he's a 95-year-old man who lives in Delafield, Wisconsin, still has his son's Corvette in his garage. He took me down there. He lifted this quilt off of the Corvette. And he was one of the only living parents that we found on the list of 64.
So obviously this means a lot to people. It's still personal in many cases, and it seems as though there have been so many incredible stories along the way in finding these photos. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what led to the photo of James Calvin Ward, maybe the shorthand version.
Oh, yes. James Calvin Ward was one of our most moving stories. He was the 17-year-old African-American service member who enlisted from Milwaukee. His parents had to sign him in because he was so young. As a result of his death and another 17-year-old, the Defense Department banned service in combat by juveniles in Vietnam, so there were a few stories about that. We eventually traced his family through the obituary of his father, who was a military man and the son of a sharecropper from Arkansas by the name of J.C. Ward. He had died a few years ago in El Paso. That allowed us to track down other members of J.C. Ward, the father's family. However, you know, person after person after person told us they had no photo of James Calvin Ward. We reached a sibling of his father in Vegas. She had no photo. Sent us to another aunt in Michigan. She had no photo, but then said maybe she did, but she was too infirm to come to the door, and, you know, she's very elderly. Sent us to another cousin who had no photo, who then revealed that James Calvin Ward had a son he had never met, who lived in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Called that son, tracked down his phone number because nobody had it, and he revealed that he also had no photo of his father. In fact, he had never possessed a photo of his father, but he did remember one that had hung for years in his grandfather's living room, and he described it very vividly. And so for a moment, I felt like I had found James Calvin Ward's photo, but really only through the memory of his son, who had seen it but never met him. So Then we talked to the mother of the son. She had no photo, but she suggested, call back the cousins in Michigan. They're the only people that could have one if anyone has a photo of James at all. We tried the schools, by the way. That didn't pan out either. So call back the cousin in Michigan, and in the interim, the elderly infirm aunt who couldn't come to the door had called her and said, I found a photo. And so the cousin drove over there, took a picture of it with her cell phone, and texted me a wonderful, moving photo of James Ward in his military uniform, which we now will be providing to his son so that his son has a photo for the first time. And there were other cases like that where we realized the family members did not have photos of their loved one. And so then the effort became as much to find a photo for them as it is for the people in Washington who eventually want to run all of these in a major education center they're fundraising to build across the street.
Jessica, amazing stories. Thank you so much for sharing and for telling us about all the effort that's gone into them.
Well, thank you for, you know, broadcasting the effort. I do hope people go and to Media Milwaukee and read some of the stories because they're so rich, they're so moving. And on this Memorial Day, I really think it's important that we pause and we don't just remember names or generically the people who serve, but that we take the time to really understand who they were as human beings and properly remember them that way.
Jessica, thank you. That was Jessica McBride, Senior Lecturer of Journalism at UW-Milwaukee. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back tomorrow. Well, Memorial Day is the unofficial start of summer, which means the start of summer movie season. Ever since Jaws broke the box office in 75, summer's always been the big season for movie releases. This year we have a lot of sequels, prequels, remakes coming out, a lot of them opening on the same weekend and competing with each other. And we're taking your calls on this. What summer movies are you excited to see? Are you a fan of summer movie season? You can call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. David Edelstein joins us now. He's the chief film critic for New York Magazine, Vulture.com, and NPR's Fresh Air. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So even though it's just now Memorial Day, it kind of feels like summer movie season has started. We've had The Avengers, we've had Mad Max, both of those getting a bit of buzz. So when do you think of summer movie season as really starting?
I hate to say it, but I kind of think summer movie season is all year round now, except with the notable exception of October, November, and December, when it's Oscar bait season. But the rest of the time, there really is, when we spoke of the old era of summer movies, from, say, 75 Jaws and Star Wars in 76 or 77, that was when there were grown-up movies the rest of the year. But you've got superhero movies that come out all year round now. You've got these huge Marvel, what they now call universes, that have established footholds in the year-round schedule. So I don't know that it's that much of a distinction anymore. I know this program is about summer movies. So you can maybe see more of them, a greater concentration of them, an idea that people are free, that kids are free, and they'll be able to see two and three in a week instead of one in a week. That's about it.
Summer movie going to me feels different than it does in the winter. There's just something about going on a late summer night that feels distinct to me from seeing movies the rest of the time of the year. You know, Wisconsin has very distinct seasons. So for me, that's part of it.
Does Wisconsin still have drive-ins?
I think there are a couple of them left, too. Yeah, not a lot, but there are a few.
Well, my wife's parents have a house in the beach in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and one of the last remaining drive-ins, and it is always a great summer ritual to go to the drive-in. I really envy people who live near a drive-in, and there's just something wonderful. There's something wonderful, first of all, about seeing a double feature. It used to be you would see triple features, and on those rare occasions, they would show, say, five really crappy horror movies that would go from dusk to dawn, and there was nothing better than that. That, to me, is a true summer movie experience.
Well, we'll see how this one goes over. We've got the third or fourth Jurassic Park, but a reboot of Jurassic Park coming out. What do you know about that one?
Well, it's funny. You're asking me about a lot of movies that I haven't seen, and I don't trust people who, especially critics, when they opine about things that they haven't seen. I will say that with a Jurassic Park introduced back in the 90s, an extraordinary new kind of animation that instantly blew away our beloved stop-motion animation by people like Willis O'Brien of King Kong and Ray Harryhausen of Jason and the Argonauts. So all of a sudden you saw these much more fluid, lifelike dinosaurs. And when a new Jurassic Park movie comes out, I think it's fair to say that we expect to see the next iteration of technology to give us even more lifelike dinosaurs, and that will probably involve 3D. It will probably involve greater immersion. You may find even greater articulation among the dinosaurs. But I haven't seen the film. The early word on it is very good.
And one thing I noticed, this one is rated R, so I think that's a difference. I believe some of the earlier ones were PG-13, but in either case, here's a clip.
Every time we've unveiled a new attraction, attendance has spiked.
That was awesome.
Corporate felt genetic modification would up the wow factor.
They're dinosaurs. Wow enough.
Little taste there of the coming Jurassic Park. That one's coming out in June. I want to ask you about another film. This one's got a really interesting backstory on it, the movie Dope, which I gather had trouble getting people to support it early on, and then it kind of killed at Sundance. What happened with that one?
It was a huge critical hit and an audience favorite. Again, I haven't seen it. I am seeing it on Tuesday. It doesn't come out until June. I think the official release date is June 19th, but it's about a kid in Los Angeles in a very bad neighborhood who is simply going through the kinds of things that more affluent kids in other parts of the country take for granted: college applications, SAT exams, and dope is being used in this sense not to talk about drugs, but to denote the fact that he wants to be and indeed becomes dope. You see?
Gotcha. Well, we've got a little taste of that one.
You go to high school in Inglewood. Think you're going to get into Harvard?
I'm from a poor, crime-filled neighborhood, raised by a single mother, don't know my dad, blah, blah.
It's cliche.
All right, a little bit of the rags to riches, a story of Cinderella there. The backstory, the actual plot is a little bit different. Well, here's one I think that you have seen, David, Tomorrowland.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually one of the few who thinks it's a terrific movie with some major reservations. It is a real throwdown. Brad Bird, the director, is really throwing down the gauntlet to popular culture. This is a movie that very aggressively takes a stand against the culture of nihilism, the apocalypse movie, the movies that almost make a fetish of the end of the world, zombie plagues, Terminator robots exterminating mankind. He's really saying that that something has gone wrong with our popular culture. To use the Doctor Strangelove line, in a way, we've learned to stop worrying and love the bomb too much. What complicates it, and I think it's a very Brad Bird is a great director. The Incredibles and Ratatouille and The Iron Giant and the fourth Mission Impossible film, Ghost Protocol. He's also a bit of an Ayn Randian, so you've got some very weird disjunctive politics in there. Like he almost makes the villains the science teachers who talk too much about global warming because their negativity dampens the imagination of the young children who will go out and try to figure out solutions to the problems. You're probably thinking, well, that doesn't make very much sense. And no, it doesn't make very much sense, but it's very much in line with his weird politics. The movie hasn't gotten too many good reviews. I think I probably liked it more than other people. I think it's a beautiful piece of storytelling, very exciting if you can kind of lop off those weird politics.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're one of the few positive reviews that I've seen, but on the other hand, you also like the young woman who you think is going to be a breakout star.
Well, she's darling. chilling. She's, if you've seen Felicity Jones, she looks like a young Felicity Jones. You know, she's this British girl with this kind of darling overbite and very poised, always unflappable, in command. I think she's terrific. But you know what? If the movie tanks, nobody's going to come out of it looking well. I'm very surprised if it tanks, because I thought this one, I usually have decent instincts. Even if I hate a movie, I know it's going to be a hit. But this one I thought would really reach a pretty wide audience. And I also thought that cultural message, enough apocalypse movies. You know, one of the things that is interesting about, it's not just that we love seeing cities destroyed. It's that because of computer-generated imagery, we can now do it so easily. You know, in the old days, a disaster movie was a real occasion. But now, since everything is done inside of a computer, and you have armies and armies of special effects people, and you also have the Chinese and the Asian market clamoring for IMAX and 3D and spectacle, you're going to see a lot more movies in which San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles are going to, you know, fall, and either Godzilla is going to stomp them, or aliens are going to destroy them, or they're going to get nuked, or whatever. And it really is, it's really about the technology, just like Jurassic Park. It's about the technology is leading. The technology is leading. It's not that these people have this really passionate, you know, desire to destroy San Francisco or New York again.
But don't you think part of it is also what you see going on in literature, that books are leading movies, Hunger Games and Divergent?
Yes.
Those franchises are leading it, and that's what's
Absolutely. In
You're young
right.
adult. It's
You're
dystopian
right. The dystopian
stuff
to an alarming degree, and I should say that I think Brad Bird in Tomorrowland is also targeting that. There are so many movies now in which, YA novels in which kids kill kids. I mean, it was very rare when I was growing up that you would read books in which just kids would die by the hundreds, often at the hands of other kids, or they would commit suicide, this weird sense now that popular culture is telling us that the way we live now is doomed, one way or another. Our way of life is unsustainable. Now, politically, I happen to think that is the sort of thing that would galvanize people, and I would, in theory, approve of that in pop culture. Brad Bird argues that, in fact, as I said, it has the opposite effect. We're learning to kind of, if you will, dig the apocalypse, dig the idea of dystopia. If nothing else, it'll make a break.
We're talking right now with film critic David Edelstein about the upcoming crop of summer movies and a whole lot more. And we're taking your calls. Are you into the idea of summer movie season, or do you feel like David said, that it's sort of always summer movie season these days? And what do you think? Are you tired of dystopian movies? Are you tired of seeing killer robots and kids killing kids on screen? Are you ready for something a little different? Maybe the next trend in filmmaking, and maybe literature too. Call 800-642-1234. Let us know what you're looking for in your summer movie. We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in a minute. Right now, Kristen Durst joins us from the newsroom with this check of headlines. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion now with film critic David Edelstein, talking about summer movie season, which officially more or less kicks off today. And we're taking your calls. What do you look forward to seeing in theaters this summer? Is there something you're looking forward to? Do you still see movies in the theater, or do you just wait and stream it later online on Netflix? What is the benefit, do you think, of seeing a movie in the theater? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, David, there's another one coming out I'm curious about, because it features a new lady in comedy whose star really seems to be on the rise, Amy Schumer. What do you know about Trainwreck?
Oh, well, I've been an Amy Schumer freak for many years, dating even before her show. And I love her. I love the aggressively filthy nature of her comedy, and the way she puts her kind of masochism and sort of culturally induced self-loathing about her aspects of her body. She uses it, and I think she conquers it in the process. Rather than perpetuating stereotypes, she challenges them. This is my way of saying that I don't know if the movie is going to represent that kind of sensibility that I've loved from her. It's a Judd Apatow production. Again, don't trust anybody who tells you, like I'm just telling you, that, you know, who prejudges something. It could be a masterpiece. It looks to me like a much more conventional piece of work than maybe I would have expected from her. But, you know, if it does well, if she proves to be a box office draw, then she can pretty much write her own ticket, maybe.
And this is a bit from the trailer. Maybe we can prejudge at least this.
Okay, we can prejudge the trailer.
Okay.
Girls, your mother and I are getting divorced. Monogamy isn't realistic.
Monogamy isn't realistic.
Again.
Monogamy isn't realistic.
I didn't understand that word at the time, but now I know exactly what he was talking about.
It looks like a fun movie. She's someone, I'm not like you, I didn't really know a lot about her until recently, so it'll be interesting, like you said, to see whether this translates into box office success.
Well, it's interesting because the subject of her, look, it's a very, very cruel world out there for actresses and female comedians who are not conventionally, although I think she's extremely attractive, but she has made her own hotness or lack thereof the direct subject of many of her shows. In fact, she even did a remake of 12 Angry Men with people in a room with black and white cinematography debating whether or not she was hot enough to have her own show. And the question is, what will the multiplex audience make of her, and will you get the usual chorus of sort of disgusting, sexist, lookist comments from the fanboys, or will, you know, and the sorts of things that Melissa McCarthy
right.
has been getting all along, too.
And she's got a new one coming out, too. But let's go to a caller first. I want to get in here. Chris joins us in Germantown. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Hello.
My comment was you had asked about theaters and whether or not theaters would begin to draw people again. I was telling your screener, I'm 55, and I really had kind of fallen away from going to theater because I enjoyed watching a movie on DVD at home, at my own convenience. I could pause it if I wanted to go to the restroom, that sort of thing. But we went to the Marcus Theater to see the new Mad Max that came out recently, and we saw it in Menominee Falls, my son and I and a couple of friends.
See it in 3D? Did you see it in 3D?
No, sir, I did not go quite that far. But I just have to say the experience of the theater was, I hadn't expected it to be that nice. I have to really, really applaud Marcus what they did to the inside. It was a reserved seat. I'd never heard of anything like that. Recliners. The surround sound was tremendous. The experience was something I definitely would repeat. I didn't know theaters had gone that direction. It was really comfortable. It was a clean, pleasant environment. I can't highly recommend the movie. The movie itself, but the experience in the theater was great, and I will go again.
Okay, well, Chris, thank you for that. So I think I've seen this trend here in Madison where I live. Theaters all over seem to be stepping it up, and maybe according to Chris, it's working. So, David, your thoughts on that, and also maybe give us a little bit of your mind on Mad Max.
Well, they have to, obviously, because so many movies now are being released on video, actually video on demand at the same time. Listen, I review for Fresh Air, and it's good for me in one sense in that I'm able to review a lot more movies for a national audience, for Fresh Air's national audience, and not worry about the fact that these movies are only playing in New York and Los Angeles. So if more people have access to these movies, it's great. On the other hand, I love the theatrical experience, and I think it's very different from the TV experience. The caller said that he could stop at any time he wanted. See, I think that's a problem when you're watching a movie at home, the fact that you have control. I end up reviewing a lot of movies that get sent to me now on screener DVDs, and I force myself to put the remote in the other room. So I sit on the sofa, and you pay more attention when somebody else is screening it, when you don't have that means of control, it's you have much more of a connection. You're much more alert to it. You can't sort of get lost in your thoughts and say, oh, well, I can always rewind it, or, you know, stop to go to the bathroom or answer a phone call or see if you have any email.
So you like that urgency. But so with Mad Max, a movie that's got a lot of urgency, what do you think? Did you like that one?
Mad Max is there are people calling it the greatest action movie in 50 years. It's not. In some ways, I like the Road Warrior, the second of the Mad Max movies, better because it's a little more modest. It's a lot cleaner. George Miller, the director, just throws everything at you. It's still great fun. And if you're going to see it, I suggest seeing it on the biggest screen imaginable and seeing it in 3D, because it's just one of these movies where he's always throwing things into the camera, and spears are sticking into the camera, and car grills are roaring into the camera, and body parts are, you know, spiraling into the camera, and you really want, if you're going to do it, if you're going to go for the sort of carnival, you know, thrill ride aspect of it, this is a movie to see on a big screen, and it's a movie to see with everything that technology can offer. I'm not a huge fan of 3D, but there are occasional directors like James Cameron and now George Miller who use it very effectively. And so I would say, if you're an action junkie, then this is a pretty darn good movie.
Gotcha. Well, a lot of people are liking that one. David, thank you so much for joining us and giving us your take on what's coming up this summer.
I hope it wasn't too cynical, but I think there's going to be a lot of great movies coming out this summer, and people should listen to Fresh Air and hear more about it, or go to vulture.com.
Gotcha, and it's always good news. Good movies equals good news. That was David Edelstein, chief film critic of New York Magazine and vulture.com. He was with us to give us a peek at the upcoming summer movie season.